free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Thursday, June 26th, 2014. Today, we're talking to Brian McClanahan, an old friend of mine for a number of years now, the author of several books, including The Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Founding Fathers, and the book we'll be talking about today, of which he is the co-author, Forgotten Conservatives in American History. Brian wrote this with Clyde Wilson, who is the editor of the Calhoun Papers and is considered to be one of the great living historians of the American South. As a matter of fact, Eugene Genovese, who was himself one of the great Southern historians of the 20th century, said that Clyde is certainly in the top 10 in that category. And Brian was actually Clyde's last PhD student. So Clyde's a great guy, extremely knowledgeable, as is Brian. Brian also teaches U.S. history with me over at libertyclassroom.com, which you can get a seriously big chunk of a discount at by using coupon code DISCOUNT in all caps at libertyclassroom.com. You can get 60% off at libertyclassroom.com when you become a supporting listener of the show. You get transcripts of all the interviews. You get discounts at Liberty retailers all over the place, plus 60% off at libertyclassroom.com. Become a supporting listener at supportinglisteners.com. Now, let's get to Brian McClanahan. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom. Appreciate it.
As I was flipping through this book, which I've had for some time now, it occurred to me that this is material for multiple shows. Because instead of covering a whole bunch of people 30 seconds at a time, I think we should take them and give them the treatment they deserve, because they're all interesting in one way or another. And
sure.
I was, before we went on, we were talking about which ones of these people would be most interesting perhaps for the audience, and maybe we get started with those. And you had exactly the thoughts that I did. I was thinking about Sumner and Cleveland. So let's get started talking about them. I would bet a good chunk of this audience knows at least the name William Graham Sumner. So give us the background on Sumner, and then we'll talk about what it was that he thought and the sorts of forbidden opinions that he uttered.
Right. Well, I mean, Sumner was, in so many ways, in my opinion, the best sociologist in American history. I mean, you hear that term sociologist, and immediately your eyes are going to roll back. Oh, no.
Yeah, and if he's the best one in American history, talk about the faintest praise in the history of the world.
Right, because everyone thinks, oh, sociologists are all just these. They've all had a sociology class where it's this cultural Marxist who comes in and tells you, whatever that they think they believe about that. So you have Sumner, who's a sociologist, but he was great. I mean, here's a guy that was just the epitome of the antithesis of whatever you think of sociologists are today. His positions on the economy, on war, on politics, society, I mean, they're refreshing. And you go out and you think, this guy was a sociologist? I mean, my gosh. And he was writing at a time in the late 19th century when you had progressivism just really taking hold of America, and he was so much against it. And the great thing about Sumner is that actually at one point, I think that because of Sumner, people thought progressivism is dead because he ripped it apart so easily. And then it has this resurgence, of course, in the early 20th century. But Sumner is just this great classical liberal. And I know we call the book is, Forgotten Conservatives, but Sumner is more accurately a classical liberal or a libertarian in many ways that was very concerned about the power of the state and, of course, the expansion of the state in terms of the economy and, of course, war as well, and what that would do to what he called forgotten man, the individual who's being left behind in all of this stuff.
Let's talk about, I want to get to the forgotten man later, Let's talk about an essay Sumner wrote, The Conquest of the United States by Spain. A very interesting essay and a very cutesy kind of title, because, of course, the reader will think to himself, well, I don't recall the United States having been conquered by Spain. What could this madman have in mind? What does he mean by that? It's perhaps not meant to be so literal.
Right, absolutely. Of course, he wrote that essay at the conclusion, or about the time of the Spanish-American War, and the United States won. So how are you saying that the United States is conquered by Spain? We won the war. What are you talking about? Well, he was saying, look, okay, yeah, we won the war, but what happened? What we did through this war was pervert the American tradition, which was anti-imperialism. Now we've become this imperialist country. We've gone out and acquired colonies. We've acquired Cuba and Guam and Puerto Rico. We've acquired these places. And so we've, in the Philippines, we've essentially become just like Spain. In the 16th and 17th centuries, we have become an international or world power through imperialist motives. And so he was taking America to task for this, the American foreign policy leaders, and saying, this is wrong. What we're doing here is destroying everything we've built up to 1898. Now, I think you could contend that the United States had some imperialist motives at other times in history, but he's saying, at this point, we've turned the corner. We're no longer what we used to be. We're now just like Spain, and that is to be not loved or admired. It's something we should be just opposing completely. So that's why that little cutesy title works, and it's such a powerful essay. If you haven't read it, I mean, you should go out and read that. It should be one of the top essays to read in terms of anti-imperialism in the United States.
You know what? Offhand, I can't remember. Gosh, this is what happens when you get to be my age. First of all, when you get to be my age, you get to start saying when you get to be my age. I can't remember if we used any portion of that essay in our book, We Who Dared to Say No to War. If we did, I'm glad we did. And if we didn't, the only reason we wouldn't have is that I would feel like it was a bit hackneyed at this point because everybody's read it. But, you know, there's always a point in somebody's life where he hasn't read even a classic essay. You know, you have to provide these things to people. So shame on me if I didn't. What does he mean by the forgotten man?
Well, forgotten man is the guy that's been left behind, because essentially what you have in society when you get to a plutocracy, which is what he was saying America was, is you have one class getting the benefits, the wealthy, and then you would have in a sociological or a socialism construct, you would have another section, the poor, ostensibly getting benefits, and the people in the middle are left behind in this entire process. So you have the rich always going for their own interests, and of course, because of democracy, they're going to oftentimes pander to the poor to give them their interests, but in the middle, everyone else is getting taxed to death. They're not getting any benefits from the system. They're being destroyed, and so that's what he said. This is the forgotten man. The man, essentially, that goes out, pays his taxes, works a job, does everything that he's supposed to do, yet he's getting hit from both ends of the system and getting nothing out of it.
Let's shift to Grover Cleveland. If you ask libertarians in particular for favorite presidents, well, generally they'll roll their eyes and say, I don't want to talk about my favorite politicians, for heaven's sake, of all the possible things you could ask me. But if you really, really press, you usually get a handful, and Cleveland is in that handful. What is it that makes Cleveland, what you call him in this chapter title, the last Jeffersonian president?
Well, I think Cleveland, in reality, and I believe he was really the last. I mean, you can make a case for maybe Coolidge or Reagan, but he really was the last conservative president we had in the founding tradition in the United States. And that's because Cleveland looked at the office the way that the founding generation looked at the office. For example, now when he came into office, you had the Republicans controlling Congress, or at least for years, and they had been doing all kinds of things, unconstitutional legislation. And he came in and used the veto as the founding generation intended it, as a wrecking ball against unconstitutional legislation. So all the Congress was passing, what he was vetoing mostly were pension bills. And he was saying these things are completely unconstitutional, so he vetoed them. And, of course, the Congress could go irate about this stuff, go bonkers that he was doing this. But he issued more vetoes than anyone combined before him. So he's vetoing all this legislation because it was unconstitutional. He believed in sound money. He believed in free trade, a limited central authority. So all the things that we talk about that made the first five presidents, for the most part, very good, was what Cleveland was trying to do. And he was anti-imperialist. So this guy really personified that Jeffersonian tradition in the late 19th century, and he was the last one to do it.
Yeah, say a little something about what happened in Hawaii under the Cleveland's watch, as opposed to what happened under McKinley's watch.
Right. Well, so you had this issue of Hawaii, and essentially, you know, Hawaii is hanging out there in the Pacific, a halfway point between China and California, and so you had American interests in Hawaii, and there was this fear at one point that the Japanese would take it over, and so then we would lose Hawaii. So you had these British and American sugar growers essentially there, and they were saying, okay, here's what we need to do. We need to take Hawaii back from the ruling class in Hawaii, the Hawaiian people, the monarch, and we're going to try to push for annexation to the United States. So they do it. They lead a coup, and they take Hawaii by force, and Cleveland refused to recognize it. He said, no, I'm not going to recognize the situation. This was essentially illegal. I don't think you've taken it, but I'm not going to recognize what you've done because that's not the American way. And of course, when he's out of office and McKinley's in office, they just codify what the American interests had done there by overthrowing the Queen and taking it through a coup, which they used the United States Navy to do it without the government in Washington knowing about it. This was a disaster in terms of foreign policy, and Cleveland recognized that and said, "No, you know, I'm not going to back this. I'm not going to support this." Whereas when McKinley became president, he did it, 100%.
Now, if I'm remembering correctly, there was agitation on the part of some Americans with regard to intervening in Cuba, even in the second term of Cleveland, and his response to this was to say that even if you were to go ahead and declare war and want to intervene in Cuba, I'm the commander-in-chief and I just won't call out the troops. Now, I've never heard of any president saying something like that, and that just bowls me over, that there was somebody who was saying that I, as the president, am going to be the restraining force when it comes to foreign policy. I mean, what is this, right? Some kind of crazy, bizarro world we're in. All right, I want to take the rest of our time, though, to talk about a figure that I think libertarians need to know about, even though he was not a libertarian, he was a conservative, but he's a conservative that, for the sake of cultural literacy, you need to know about him. Now, the average American has no idea who he is, so you can be culturally literate without knowing who M.E. Bradford is. But he saw what the neocons were up to before they even realized what they were up to. He, in that debate that he had with Harry Jaffa, was already putting his finger on how unconservative the neocons were, and what they were really pushing was a condition of permanent revolution, the absolute opposite of conservatism, and really the opposite of libertarianism. I mean, Bradford is a guy that libertarians ought to respect, because not only because he was a smart guy, he was a gentleman, but he was prescient. He saw what these bad guys were up to very early on.
Absolutely. And of course, he was blacklisted by the Reagan administration for it.
Yeah, he was blacklisted all through the conservative movement, which is all you need to know about what a great guy he must have been.
Right, and Bradford, if you don't, he taught English, and so he was an English professor and taught the classics in Texas, and he was in so many ways kind of one of the last of what they called the Southern agrarians, and he wasn't. He wasn't that old. He died in the 90s. I think it's 1994, actually. But he wrote, and as you brought up Harry Jaffa, his main point was, look, okay, so we have this founding generation, and his book on the founding generation, and of course the Constitution, and he went through and looked at all the delegates of the Philadelphia Convention and talked about who they were, and this was fantastic. But he wrote essays on the founding generation overall and some different individuals in it, but what he essentially said was Jaffa is wrong because he's distorting the Declaration of Independence and this idea that all men are created equal and what that actually meant. In fact, he started differentiating between equality with a lowercase e and equality with a capital E.
All right, before you go any further, tell people who Jaffa is, because I neglected to.
Well, okay, Jaffa was a Straussian. He really is a nobody when it comes down to it. But he's a history professor, and I can't remember where he taught, but
I think it was one of the Claremont colleges on the West Coast, and when you say he's a nobody, you're not just insulting him gratuitously. When we talk about in the field, He's not held in high regard at all. It's only by his fellow Straussians that he's held in high regard, like as if he's writing Holy Scripture, but no one else really thinks much of him.
Right, that's exactly right. So, I mean, he's not Forrest MacDonald or Gordon Wood.
He's
not somebody that's written some great books on the founding era. He just had this idea that the Declaration essentially was a conservative document and the principles behind it were really conservative. And so this idea of equality, you know, this is it. But as Bradford pointed out, you can't do that. You're distorting what they meant by these things. And so he took him to task. And of course, this also led to a discussion of Lincoln. And this is where Bradford got in a lot of trouble because he pointed out that Lincoln really wasn't a conservative. And all the neocons went bonkers over this. Well, how can you not call Lincoln a conservative? And he was. But as Bradford said, no, he's not a conservative in the American tradition. He's distorting, perverting this idea of union and the founding principles. And so as Bradford continued to write, he really started articulating what the Southern agrarian conservative tradition was. And in fact, it's interesting we're talking about that because Kevin Gutzman and I have been having this conversation today on Facebook about this very thing, which is kind of funny. But, you know, what is American conservatism? Is it this Hamilton line all the way through Lincoln, which Jaffa would say, of course, looking at Jefferson's declaration is kind of the basis of that in some ways, or is it something else? And Bradford would be on the side of saying, no, you neocons are wrong. You can't love Lincoln and really be a conservative. And, of course, that led to his eventual ostracism from the conservative movement.
It's interesting, Brian, that Russell Kirk, who's sort of an intellectual godfather for conservatives of all stripes, said, I think in his book, A Program for Conservatives, I don't remember exactly which one, that Hamilton does not qualify as a conservative because he was an innovator in so many ways, and conservatism is opposed to reckless innovation. But let me back up on Bradford and Jaffa a bit. Seems to me that, and we talked a little bit about this when we had Marshall DeRosa on the program, that's our mutual friend, and he's written a very good essay on nomocratic and teleocratic regimes. And that's really what this issue between Jaffa and Bradford boils down to, that Jaffa is claiming that the American regime is teleocratic and Bradford that it's nomocratic. In other words, Jaffa is looking at the Declaration of Independence and saying this is an ideological mandate for American society and for all societies, that society must be arranged according to the principle of equality. And what Bradford is saying is that, no, we don't have grand, overarching abstractions that begin with capital letters like capital E, equality. We just have a society here where people can live the way they want to live. Now, that sounds a lot more like the libertarian message than what Jaffa is saying. Now, a libertarian may say, well, wait a minute, I believe in equality. What's the problem with Jaffa saying that equality is the key to everything? The problem with it is, one of the problems with it is, that equality is one of these concepts that once that particular genie is out of the bottle, it never goes back in again. And your view of equality, Lincoln's view of equality, may not be the same as Hillary Clinton's view of equality, which may not be the same as Cornel West's view of equality. And each one of them will be saying, I'm simply trying to carry out the political, philosophical mandate of this country. And that means that I have to impose all kinds of egalitarian schemes on the society. It leads to a condition of permanent revolution. That was Bradford's warning.
Exactly right. And, of course, that capital, it's hard to explain that to people when you say there's equality with a capital E and equality with a lowercase e. They don't get it. But what he's pointing out is, you know, look, equality with a capital E, essentially, if you want that, then talk about the French Revolution, because that's what that was. And so, essentially, you're carrying that forward. It's a perpetual revolution. There's perpetual innovation because you're never going to achieve it, and it's a moving target. And so when you have that, you're going to continually disrupt society and, of course, destroy everything in its path to get what you want, and you're never going to say you have it. And we see that now, right? I mean, look at what the central government is doing today. They're never happy with anything, so they keep changing, or as Obama simply said, remaking America over and over because it only fits within the confines of their head. This is what we have to have, and so we're going to do this, this, and this to enforce it. But then the next one comes along, and they do something else. And so there's continual disruption, and there's no peace in that. And I think that's the important thing about Bradford's position, and, of course, libertarian. It's peaceful. It's very peaceful, and I think that's something we really have to hammer home. This is not violent. The capital equality is violent. What we're advocating is peace. Get along. You have your you have your society or what you think is great. We have ours, and just leave each other alone.
Yeah.
What's so bad about that?
And, of course, when you say that equality can never be reached, of course, you're right. I mean, the classic example is the thought experiment that Robert Nozick gave about Wilt Chamberlain. He said that Wilt Chamberlain's a great basketball player, and let's say everybody began with equal incomes and equal wealth, but as soon as Wilt Chamberlain comes onto the scene, they all want to go watch him play basketball. So everybody, let's say everybody pays a dollar to go see Wilt Chamberlain play basketball. Now Wilt Chamberlain suddenly has a lot of money and nobody else does. So what is the and everybody else has $1 less than he had before. So what's the proper solution to this? Is it that Chamberlain, after providing the basketball service, should then be required to turn around and give everybody his money back? Like, what? This makes no sense. So this idea of equality, it can never be reached. That's why government loves it, because it gives it a constant pretext for intervention. And I love your view that they're never satisfied. I always say this about the left. They never get to a point where they say, okay, American society is just the way we want it. We don't need to change anything else. We finally got here. That ain't never going to happen, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, where can you show me an example where they've ever been happy with what's there? I don't think you can find one. It's always, well, okay, yeah, this is better, but we could do more. I mean, this is okay, but there's always more work to do. You hear that phrase all the time. We have more work to do.
Yeah.
What work? I mean, what does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. And we are the raw materials in that work. It's disturbing. Why do you think the people in your book are forgotten?
Well, that's a very good question. I think they're not all forgotten in certain circles. I mean, you think about, as we said, William Graham Sumner. I mean, people know who he is if you're a libertarian, but if you're not a libertarian, you've probably never heard of him before.
Right.
Or, you know, people know who Grover Cleveland is. Oh, yeah, he's the guy that served two non-consecutive terms, but they know nothing about him other than that. He's a trivia question. Or John Tyler. Oh, yeah, he's the guy that, you know, assumed the president after that old president died, right, and after a month in office. He's that guy. The problem is that these guys articulated positions that are completely contrary to the established norms in society today. I mean, they are not what people want to hear. They want to hear the stuff, the greatness of Lincoln or the greatness of Roosevelt or the greatness of some you know, political philosopher that advocates a leftist position. I mean, these are the people that are studied because those are the people that like them, and they have the control over the thought process. And so I think that's why the neoconservatives dominate the intellectual element of American conservatism. Libertarians, of course, are making great strides, but for years they weren't really a factor in the American political discourse. And so I think that's it. I mean, you just don't have people out there who talk about these people the way they should. And when we were actually pitching the book, we had to go with a very small publisher because nobody wanted to publish it. And it's unfortunate because, I mean, we thought this is good stuff that people need to know.
Yeah, that's interesting because you have published with Regnery, which is a major publisher. It's been around since 1947, published all kinds of big names. Like, if you think of the big names of the conservative movement, they were published by Regnery or its antecedent, Henry Regnery Company. So that's interesting to me. I think another factor here is that these particular individuals don't fit into neat little categories. This one's a conservative, this one's a liberal in the modern sense. Well, these people are not neoconservatives, which is unfortunately what conservatism in the modern sense has become. They certainly do not accept any of the pieties of modern liberalism. So there's no place for them in the comic book story of America. There's no place for them. And of course, if they have some misgivings whatsoever about the course of American foreign policy, then they have to simply be erased from history.
Well, you know, we actually pitched the book to Regnery, and they turned it down.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was driving at. I'm partly surprised and partly not surprised. And I don't mean to, you know, neither one of us wants to insult Regnery. I mean, they do what they do because they want to sell books, and they just try and they go for the books they think will sell. And if they think this book won't sell as well as they want it to, it doesn't mean that they're bad. It means that, frankly, the conservative readership is unreliable when it comes to offering them something that's worthy. You can't be sure they're going to want to buy it. They'd rather buy Sean Hannity's ghost-written book.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that was the response. We don't know if this is going to be successful because of our readership.
Yeah.
Whether they disagree with it. I mean, I think there are some great people at Regnery.
Yeah, and I think they would like this book, absolutely.
And but, you know, they don't know if it's not Ann Coulter, or, as you said, Sean Hannity, or, you know, take your pick. It's not It's not a book about Obama, which they're a dime a dozen now. So it's something different. And we hoped, and actually when Clyde and I were conceptualizing this, we wanted it to be in the tradition of Russell Kirk's The Conservative Mind. Well, his conservative mind is snapshots of different people that he thought articulated a conservative position.
And yet that would never, there's no conservative publisher that would be interested. Well, there are conservative publishers that would publish that today, but they wouldn't be big publishers.
Right. That's exactly right. Of course, that was published by Regner.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
And so we thought, well, this is going to be great. I mean, somebody's going to want to eat this up. And it, you know, but for example, Sam Ervin, we'll talk about him. But he was a Democrat. So I mean, also people get in that mindset. Well, if he's a Democrat, then he's really not like me because I'm a Republican.
Yeah.
So you have that situation going on.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, and that's of course a big part of the Regnery audience. I'll just say in closing that when Kevin Gutzman and I wrote Who Killed the Constitution, our naive idea was that we would appeal across ideological lines by blaming everybody. Unfortunately, that's just not how books are sold. They just are not sold. Hey, everybody has a share of the blame. Nope. You have to sell it. This is the book for conservatives. This is the book for libertarians. This is the book for liberals. That's what people want, unfortunately. So it's it can be a struggle. Brian, we'll have to have you back and talk more about some of these forgotten people. I know you got to run and go teach. So go do that good work, and we'll have you back soon.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Okay, everybody. Before I get to what we're covering tomorrow, it looks like I'm going to be speaking in the Washington, D.C. area on August 1st, which, by the way, is my birthday. So I'll be doing that. Then I've got the event August 15th you guys know about in Nashville. I haven't yet posted the D.C. event because I don't think it's been made public that I'm speaking there. Eventually, it'll be on my events page at tomwoods.com. tomwoods.com/events is the events page. Of course, you can subscribe to my newsletter, and then you make sure and get all the details on what I'm doing, what I'm writing, what's on the show, all kinds of things like that. It's free. It's non-annoying. You get a free ebook for signing up. You can do that at tomwoods.com or at tomwoodsradio.com. So keep an eye on that. Of course, I'll be speaking at the Mises Institute starting on July 20th and carrying on for about a week for their Mises University Summer Program, but that will be just for people who are in that program. Judge Andrew Napolitano will be there. It's going to be a wonderful time that week. I am getting started now on the next courses I'm doing for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program at ronpaulhomeschool.com, Western Civilization 1, and my government course, Government 1B. People have already taken those courses. Those are available over at ronpaulhomeschool.com. I'm doing courses mainly for the 9th, 10th, and 11th grades. So I'm starting a course on the U.S. Constitution. And yes, I am going to mention Lysander Spooner in that course. But I've prepared about the first three or so weeks, so I'm going through the colonial constitutions, the various charters, covenants, compacts that were written. Then I'm going through the American Revolution and looking at it as a constitutional conflict, which is exactly what it was. And then in the coming week, I'm going to be doing the Philadelphia Convention. I'll spend three sessions on that. We'll look at the debates over the Constitution. We'll look at ratification. We'll look at the early state constitutions. We'll look at the Federalist. All these key sorts of topics we'll get to. It's unbelievable how many things I'm covering in this course. When you have 180 videos, tend to cover a lot of material. I'm also going to be starting up my Western Civ 2 course in the coming weeks as well. So that's going to keep me really, really busy. Tomorrow, we're going to bring Scott Horton back to the program. Scott is a favorite among you guys, and it's no wonder. He's just so darn good. I thought he would be a good guy to talk to us about what is going on in Iraq and what the latest news is from over there. So make sure and tune in for Scott Horton. Make sure you're subscribing to the program at tomwoodsradio.com so you don't miss an episode like the return of Scott Horton. And make sure and tell your family and friends about the show. The reason we continue to do as well as we do is that you guys are helping to promote the show through social media, through word of mouth. I appreciate that. I am promoting a number of the programs on Facebook so that people are more likely to see them and be able to listen to them, and I'm able to have a budget to do that because you guys have been helping me out either as supporting listeners or by making those Amazon purchases through tomwoodsradio.com. All right, thanks for listening, everybody. Scott Horton tomorrow.
The Tom Woods Show.